considers the car, but only for an instant. Bullets now fly past them. On the southbound roadway are policemen who have finally stopped traffic on their side of the interstate and have made it to the median dividing the north and southbound lanes. The closest officer fires again. A tranq bullet hits the Cadillac and splatters. The crazy kid now puts Lev into a chokehold, holding Lev between himself and the officers. Lev realizes that he doesn't want a car or money. He wants a hostage. "Stop struggling! I've got a gun!" And Lev feels the kid poke him in the side. Lev knows it's not a gun. He knows it's just the kid's finger. But this is clearly an unstable individual, and he doesn't want to set him off.
"I'm worthless as a human shield," Lev says, trying to reason with him. "Those are tranq bullets they're shooting, which means the cops don't care if they hit me. They'll just knock me out."
"Better you than me." Bullets fly past them as they wind around swerving traffic.
"Please, you don't understand. You can't take me now. I'm being tithed. I'll miss my harvest. You'll ruin everything."
And finally, a hint of humanity comes to the maniac's eyes.
"You're an unwind?"
There are a million more things to be furious about, but Lev finds himself incensed by what he's just been called.
"I'm a tithe!"
A blaring horn, and Lev turns to see a bus bearing down on them. Before either of them has a chance to scream, the bus careens off the road to avoid them and smashes head-on against the fat trunk of a huge oak, stopping the bus cold. There's blood all over the smashed windshield. It's the bus driver's blood. He hangs halfway through, and he's not moving.
"Oh, crap,"
says the maniac, a creepy whine in his voice. A girl has just stepped out of the bus. The crazy kid looks at her, and Lev realizes that now, while he's distracted, is the last chance he's going to have to get away. This kid is an animal. The only way to deal with him is for Lev to become an animal himself. So Lev grabs the arm that's locked around his neck and sinks his teeth in with the full force of his jaws until he tastes blood. The kid screams, letting go, and Lev bolts away, racing toward his father's car. As he nears it, a back door opens. It's Pastor Dan opening the door to receive him, yet the expression on the man's face is anything but happy. With his face already swelling from the crazy kid's brutal punch, Pastor Dan says with a hiss and strange warble to his voice,
"Run, Lev!"
Lev wasn't expecting this.
"What?"
"Run! Run as fast and as far as you can! Run!"
Lev stands there, impotent, unable to move, unable to process this. Why is Pastor Dan telling him to run? Then comes a sudden pain in his shoulder, and everything starts spinning round and round and down a drain into darkness. 4. Connor. The pain in Connor's arm is unbearable. That little monster actually bit him, practically took a chunk out of his forearm. Another car slams the brakes to avoid hitting him and gets rear-ended. The tranq bullets have stopped flying, but he knows that's temporary. The accidents have gotten the juvie cops momentarily distracted, but they won't stay that way for long. Just then he makes eye contact with the girl who got off the bus. He thinks she's going to go stumbling toward all the people who are running from their cars to help, but instead she turns and runs into the woods. Has the whole world gone insane? Still holding his stinging, bleeding arm, he turns to run into the woods as well, but stops. He turns back to see the kid in white just reaching his car. Connor doesn't know where the juvie cops are. They're lurking, no doubt, somewhere in the tangle of vehicles. That's when Connor makes a split-second decision. He knows it's a stupid decision, but he can't help himself. All he knows is that he's caused death today. The bus drivers, maybe more. Even if it risks everything, he's got to balance it somehow. He's got to do something decent, something good to make up for the awful consequence of his kicking AWOL. And so, battling his own instinct for self-preservation, he races toward the kid in white who was so happily going to his own unwinding.
It's as Connor gets close that he sees the cop 20 yards away, raising his weapon and firing. He shouldn't have risked this. He should have gotten away when he could. Connor waits for the telltale sting of the tranq bullet, but it never comes, because the moment the bullet is fired, the boy in white takes a step back, and he's hit in the shoulder. 2 seconds, and his knees buckle. The kid hits the ground, out cold, unwittingly taking the bullet meant for Connor. Connor wastes no time. He picks the kid up off the ground and flips him over his shoulder. Tranq bullets fly, but no others connect. In a few seconds, Connor's past the bus, where a gaggle of shell-shocked teens are getting off. He pushes past them and into the woods. The woods are dense, not just with trees, but with tall shrubs and vines. Yet there's already a path of broken branches and parted shrubs made by the girl who ran from the bus. They might as well have arrows pointing the police in their direction. He sees the girl up ahead and calls out to her, "Stop!" She turns, but only for an instant, then renews her battle with the dense growth all around her. Connor gently puts down the boy in white and hurries forward, catching up with her. He grabs her arm gently, yet firmly enough so that she can't pull away. "Whatever you're running from, you won't get away unless we work together," he tells her. He glances behind him to make sure that no juvie cops are in sight yet. There aren't. "Please, we don't have much time." The girl stops fighting the bushes and looks at him. "What do you have in mind?" 5. Cop. Officer J.T. Nelson has spent 12 years working juvenile. He knows AWOL unwinds will not give up as long as there's an ounce of consciousness left in them. They are high on adrenaline and often high on illegal substances as well. Nicotine, caffeine, or worse. He wishes his bullets were the real thing. He wishes he could truly take these wastes of life out rather than just taking them down. Maybe then they wouldn't be so quick to run. And if they did, well, no great loss. The officer follows the path made through the woods by the AWOL unwind, until he comes to a lump on the ground. It's the hostage, just dumped in the path, his white clothes smudged green from the foliage and brown from the muddy earth. "Good," thinks the officer. It was a good thing this boy took that bullet after all. Being unconscious probably saved this kid's life. No telling where the unwind would have taken him, or what he'd have done to him.
"Help me,"
says a voice just ahead of him. It's the voice of a girl. The officer isn't expecting this.
"Help me, please, I'm hurt."
Deeper in the woods, a girl sits up against a tree, holding her arm, grimacing in pain. He doesn't have time for this, but protect and serve is more than just a motto to him. He sometimes wishes he didn't have such moral integrity. He goes over to the girl. "What are you doing here?"
"I was on the bus. I got off and ran away because I was scared it would explode. I think my arm's broken."
He looks at the girl's arm. It's not even bruised. This should be his first clue, but his mind is already too far ahead of him to catch it. "Stay here. I'll be right back." He turns, ready to pick up his pursuit, when something drops on him from above. Not something, someone. The AWOL unwind. The officer is knocked to the ground, and suddenly there are two figures attacking him, the unwind and the girl. They're in this together. How could he have been so stupid? He reaches for his tranq pistol, but it's not there. Instead, he feels its muzzle against his left thigh, and he sees triumph in the unwind's dark, vicious eyes. "Nighty-night," the unwind says. A sharp pain in the officer's leg, and the world goes away. 6. Lev. Lev wakes up to a dull ache in his shoulder. He thinks maybe he slept funny, but he quickly realizes the ache is from an injury. His left shoulder was the entry point of a tranq bullet, though he doesn't quite realize that just yet. All the things that had happened to him 12 hours before are like faint clouds in his mind that have lost their shape. All he knows for sure is that he was on his way to his tithing. He was kidnapped by a murderous teenager, and for some strange reason, the image of Pastor Dan keeps coming back to him. Pastor Dan was telling him to run,
He's sure that it must be a false memory, because he can't believe Pastor Dan would do such a thing. Everything's blurry as Lev opens his eyes. He doesn't know where he is, only that it's night, and he's not where he should be. The insane teen who took him sits across a small fire. There's a girl there, too. That's when he realizes he'd been hit by a tranq bullet. His head hurts, he feels like he might puke, and his brain is still only at half power. He tries to get up, but can't. At first he thinks that's also because of the tranquilizers, but then he realizes he's tied to a tree by thick vines. He tries to speak, but his voice comes out as a little groan and a lot of drool. The boy and girl look at him, and he's sure they're going to kill him now. They kept him alive just so he'd be awake when they killed him. Maniacs are like that. "Look who's back from Trankville," says the boy with wild eyes. Only his eyes aren't wild now, just his hair. It's all sticking up like he slept on it. Although Lev's tongue feels like rubber, he manages to get out a single word.
"Where?"
"Not sure," says the boy. Then the girl adds, "But at least you're safe."
"Safe?"
thinks Lev. "What could possibly be safe about this?"
Hostage?
Lev gets out. The boy looks to the girl, then back to Lev.
"Kind of, I guess."
These two talk in an easy tone of voice, like they're all friends.
"They're trying to lull me into a false sense of security," thinks Lev. "They're trying to get me on their side, so I'll take part in whatever criminal activities they have planned."
There's an expression for that, isn't there? When a hostage joins the kidnapper's cause? The something syndrome. The crazy kid looks to a pile of berries and nuts, obviously foraged from the woods.
"You hungry?"
Lev nods, but the act of nodding makes his head spin so much, he realizes that no matter how hungry he is, he'd better not eat, because it'll come right back up.
"No,"
he says.
"You sound confused," says the girl. "Don't worry, it's just the tranqs. They should wear off pretty soon."
Stockholm syndrome, that's it. Well, Lev won't be won over by this pair of kidnappers. He'll never be on their side.
"Pastor Dan told me to run."
What had he meant? Did he mean run from the kidnappers?
Maybe.
But he seemed to be saying something else entirely. Lev closes his eyes and chases the thought away.
"My parents will look for me,"
Lev says, his mouth finally able to put together whole sentences. The kids don't answer because they probably know it's true.
"How much is the ransom?"
Lev asks.
"Ransom? There's no ransom," says the crazy kid. "I took you to save you, idiot."
"To save him?" Lev just stares at him in disbelief.
But my tithing."
The crazy kid looks at him and shakes his head.
"I've never seen a kid in such a hurry to be unwound."
It's no use trying to explain to this godless pair what tithing is all about. How giving of oneself is the ultimate blessing. They'd never understand or care.
Save him?
They haven't saved him. They've damned him. Then Lev realizes something. He realizes that he can use this entire situation to his advantage.
"My name's Lev," he says, trying to play it as cool as he can.
"Pleased to meet you, Lev," says the girl. "I'm Risa, and this is Connor."
Connor throws her a dirty look, making it clear that she gave him their real names. Not a good idea for hostage takers, but then most criminals are stupid like that.
"Didn't mean for you to take the tranq bullet," Connor tells him, "but the cop was a bad shot."
"Not your fault,"
says Lev, even though every bit of it is Connor's fault. Lev thinks about what happened and says,
"I would never have run from my own tithing."
That much, Lev knows, is true.
"Good thing I was around then," says Connor.
"Yeah,"
says Risa.
"If it wasn't for Connor running across that highway, I'd probably be unwound by now, too."
There's a moment of silence, then Lev, biting back his anger and revulsion, says,
"Thank you. Thank you for saving me."
Don't mention it, says Connor.
Good. Let them think he's grateful. Let them think they're earning his trust. And once they're lulled into their own false sense of security, he'll make sure they both get exactly what they deserve.
7. Connor. Connor should have kept the juvie cop's gun, but he wasn't thinking. He was so freaked out at having tranked a cop with his own weapon, he just dropped it and ran, just as he dropped his backpack on the interstate so he could carry Lev. His wallet with all his money was in that pack. Now he has nothing but pocket lint. It's late now, or, more accurately, early, almost dawn. He and Risa had kept moving through the woods all day, as best they could with Connor having to carry an unconscious tithe. Once night fell, he and Risa had taken turns keeping watch while the other slept. Connor knows that Lev can't be trusted. That's why Connor tied him to the tree. But there's no reason to trust this girl who had come running out of a bus either. It's only their common goal of staying alive that binds them. The moon has left the sky now, but there's a faint glow promising a quick arrival of dawn. By now, their faces would be everywhere. Have you seen these teens? Do not approach. Considered extremely dangerous. Call the police immediately. Funny how Connor had wasted so much time in school trying to convince people he was dangerous. But when it came down to it, he was never sure if he was all that dangerous at all. A danger to himself, maybe. All the while, Lev watches him. At first, the boy's eyes had been lazy, and his head lolling to one side. But now those eyes are sharp. Even in the dimness of the dying fire, Connor can see them. Chilly blue. Calculating. This kid is an odd bird. Connor's not quite sure what's going on planet Lev, and not quite sure he wants to know.
That bite's gonna get infected if you don't take care of it, Lev says.
Connor looks to the spot on his arm where Lev bit him, still puffy and red. He had tuned the pain out until Lev reminded him.
I'll deal with it.
Lev continues to study him.
Why are you being unwound?
Connor doesn't like the question for a whole lot of reasons.
You mean why was I being unwound? Because, as you can see, I'm not being unwound anymore.
They will if they catch you.
Connor feels like punching that smug look off the kid's face, but he restrains himself. He didn't rescue the kid just to beat him up.
So what's it like? Connor asks. Knowing all your life you're going to be sacrificed?
He meant it as a jab, but Lev takes the question seriously.
It's better than going through life without knowing your purpose.
Connor's not sure if that was intentionally meant to make him squirm. As if his life has no purpose. It makes him feel like he's the one tied to a tree, not Lev.
I guess it could be worse, says Connor. We could have all ended up like Humphrey Dunphy.
Lev seems surprised by the mention of the name.
You know that story? I thought they only told it in my neighborhood.
Nah, says Connor. Kids tell it everywhere.
It's made up,
says Risa, having just woken up.
Maybe, says Connor. But there was this one time a friend and I tried to find out about it while surfing one of the school's computers. We hit this one website that talked about it and how his parents went all psycho. Then the computer crashed. Turns out we were hit by a virus that wiped out the entire district server.
Coincidence? I don't think so. Lev's taken in, but Risa, fairly disgusted, says,
Well, I'll never end up like Humphrey Dunphy, because you have to have parents for them to go psycho, and I don't.
She stands up. Connor looks away from the dying fire to see that dawn has arrived.
If we're going to keep from being caught, then we should change direction again, Risa says. We should also think about disguising ourselves.
Like how? Asks Connor.
I don't know. Change our clothes first. Haircuts, maybe. They'll be looking for two boys and a girl. Maybe I can disguise myself as a boy.
Connor takes a good look at her and smiles. Risa's pretty. Not in the way Ariana was pretty. In a better way. Ariana's prettiness was all about makeup and pigment injections and stuff. Risa has a natural kind of beauty. Without thinking, Connor reaches out to touch her hair and gently says, I don't think you could ever pass for a guy. Then suddenly he finds his hand tugged behind him. His whole body spins around and she painfully wrenches his arm up the small of his back. It hurts so much he can't even say, ouch. All he can say is, ah, ah, ah.
Touch me again and your arm gets ripped off, Risa tells him. Got that?
Yeah, yeah, fine, hands off, got it. Over at the oak tree, Lev laughs, apparently pleased to see Connor in pain. She lets him go, but his shoulder still throbs.
You didn't have to do that,
Connor says, trying not to show how much it still hurts. It's not like I was going to hurt you or anything.
Yeah, well, now you won't for sure,
says Risa, maybe sounding a bit guilty for being so harsh.
Don't forget I lived in a state home.
Connor nods. He knows about stay-ho kids. They have to learn to take care of themselves real young, or their lives are not very pleasant. He should have realized she was a touch-me-not.
Excuse me, says Lev, but we can't go anywhere if I'm tied to a tree.
Still, Connor doesn't like that judgmental look in Lev's eyes. How do we know you won't run?
You don't, but until you untie me, I'm a hostage, Lev says. Once I'm free, I'm a fugitive, like you.
Tied up, I'm the enemy.
Cut loose, I'm a friend.
If you don't run, says Connor. Risa impatiently begins untying the vines.
Unless we want to leave him here, we'll have to take that chance.
Connor kneels to help, and in a few moments, Lev is free. He stands and stretches, rubbing his shoulder where the trank bullet had hit him. Lev's eyes are still blue ice and hard for Connor to read, but he's not running. Maybe, thinks Connor, he's over the duty of being tithed. Maybe he's finally starting to see the sense of staying alive. 8. Risa. Risa finds herself unsettled by the food wrappers and broken bits of plastic they start coming across in the woods, because the first sign of civilization is always trash. Civilization means people who could recognize them if their faces have been smeared on the news net. Risa knows that staying completely clear of human contact is an impossibility. She has no illusion about their chances or their ability to remain unseen. As much as they need to remain anonymous, they cannot get by entirely alone. They need the help of others.
No, we don't.
Connor is quick to argue as the signs of civilization grow around them. It's not just trash now, but the mossy remnants of a knee-high stone wall, and the rusty remains of an old electrical tower from the days when electricity was transmitted by wires.
We don't need anyone. We'll take what we need.
Risa sighs, trying to hold together a patience that is already worn through.
I'm sure you're very good at stealing, but I don't think it's a good idea.
Connor appears insulted by the insinuation. What do you think? People are just going to give us food and whatever else we need out of the goodness of their hearts?
No, says Risa. But if we're clever about it instead of rushing into this blind, we'll have a better chance.
Her words, or maybe just her intentionally condescending tone, makes Connor storm off. Risa notices Lev watching the argument from a distance.
If he's going to run, thinks Risa, now's the time for him to do it, while Connor and I are busy fighting.
And then it occurs to her that this is an excellent opportunity to test Lev and see if he really is standing by them now or biding his time until he can escape.
Don't you walk away from me,
she growls at Connor, doing her best to keep the argument alive, all the while keeping an eye on Lev to see if he bolts.
I'm still talking to you.
Connor turns toward her. Who says I have to listen?
You would if you had half a brain, but obviously you don't.
Connor moves closer until he's deeper into her airspace than she likes anyone to get.
If it wasn't for me, you'd be on your way to harvest camp, he says.
Risa raises a hand to push him back, but his hand shoots up faster, and he grabs her wrist before she can shove him. This is the moment Risa realizes she's gone too far. What does she really know about this boy? He was going to be unwound. Maybe there's a reason for it. Maybe a good reason. Risa is careful not to struggle, because struggling gives him the advantage. She lets her tone of voice convey all the weight.
Let go of me.
Why?
Exactly what do you think I'll do to you? This is the second time you've touched me without permission,
Risa says. Still, he does not let go. Yet she does notice his grip isn't all that threatening. It isn't tight, it's loose. It isn't rough, it's gentle. She could easily pull out of it with a simple flick of her wrist. So why doesn't she? Risa knows he's doing this to make a point. But what the point is, Risa isn't sure. Is he warning her that he can hurt her if he wants to? Or maybe his message is in the gentle nature of his grip, a way of saying he's not the hurting type.
Well, it doesn't matter, thinks Risa.
Even a gentle violation is a violation. She looks at his knee. A well-placed kick could break his kneecap.
I could take you out in a second,
she threatens. If he's concerned, he doesn't show it. I know. Somehow he also knows that she won't do it. That the first time was just a reflex. If she were to hurt him a second time, though, it would be a conscious act. It would be by choice.
Step off,
she says. Her voice now lacks the force it had only moments before. This time he listens and lets go, moving back to a respectable distance. They both could have hurt one another, but neither of them did. Risa isn't quite sure what that means. All she knows is that she feels angry at him for such a mixture of reasons she can't sort them out. Then, suddenly, a voice calls to them from the right.
This is very entertaining and all, but I don't think fighting is going to help much.
It's Lev, and Risa realizes that her little ruse has backfired. She had set out to test him with a fake argument, but the argument turned real, and in the process she completely forgot about Lev. He could have taken off, and they would not have known until he was long gone. Risa throws Connor an evil look for good measure, and the three of them continue on. It isn't until 10 minutes later, when Lev goes off to relieve himself in private, that Connor talks to Risa again.
Good one, Connor says. It worked.
What?
Connor leans closer and whispers,
The argument. You put it on to see if Lev would run when we weren't paying attention, right?
Risa is bowled over.
You knew that?
Connor looks at her a bit amused.
Well, yeah.
If Risa felt uncertain about him before, it's even worse now. She has no idea what to think.
So, everything that happened back there was all a show?
Now it's Connor's turn to be unsure.
I guess, sort of, wasn't it?
Risa has to hold back a smile. Suddenly, she's feeling strangely at ease with Connor. She marvels at how that could be. If their argument had been entirely real, she'd be on her guard against him. If it had been entirely a show, she'd be on guard too, because if he could lie so convincingly, she'd never be able to trust him. But this was a mixture of both. It was real, it was pretend, and that combination made it all right. It made it safe. Like performing death-defying acrobatic tricks above a safety net. She holds on to that unexpected feeling as the two of them catch up with Lev and move toward the frightening prospect of civilization. Part 2. Storked.
You can't change laws without first changing human nature,
Nurse Greta.
You can't change human nature without first changing the law.
Nurse Yvonne.
9. Mother. The mother is 19, but she doesn't feel that old. She feels no wiser, no more capable of dealing with this situation than a little girl. When, she wonders, did she stop being a child? The law says it was when she turned 18, but the law doesn't know her. Still aching from the trauma of delivery, she holds her newborn close. It's just after dawn on a chilly morning. She moves now through back alleys. Not a soul around. Dumpsters cast angular black shadows. Broken bottles everywhere. This, she knows, is the perfect time of day to do this. There's less of a chance that coyotes and other scavengers would be out. She couldn't bear the thought of the baby suffering needlessly. A large green dumpster looms before her,
listing crookedly on the uneven pavement of the alley. She holds the baby tight, as if the dumpster might grow hands and pull the baby into its filthy depths. Maneuvering around it, she continues down the alley. There was a time, shortly after the Bill of Life was passed, that dumpsters such as that would be tempting to girls like her. Desperate girls who would leave unwanted newborns in the trash. It had become so common that it wasn't even deemed newsworthy anymore. It had become just a part of life. Funny, but the Bill of Life was supposed to protect the sanctity of life. Instead, it just made life cheap. Thank goodness for the Storking Initiative, that wonderful law that allows girls like her a far better alternative. As dawn becomes early morning, she leaves the alleys and enters a neighborhood that gets better with each street she crosses. The homes are large and inviting. This is the right neighborhood for storking. She chooses the home shrewdly. The house she decides on isn't the largest, but it's not the smallest either. It has a very short walkway to the street, so she can get away quickly, and it's overgrown with trees, so no one either inside or out will be able to see her as she storks the newborn. She carefully approaches the front door. No lights are on in the home yet. That's good. There's a car in the driveway. Hopefully that means they're home. She gingerly climbs the porch steps, careful not to make a sound, then kneels down, placing the sleeping baby on the welcome mat. There are two blankets wrapped around the baby, and a wool cap covers its head. She makes the blankets nice and tight. It's the only thing she's learned to do as a mother. She considers ringing the bell and running, but she realizes that would not be a good idea. If they catch her, she's obliged to keep the baby. That's part of the Storking Initiative, too. But if they open the door and find nothing but the child, it's finders keepers in the eyes of the law. Whether they want it or not, the baby is legally theirs. From the time she learned she was pregnant, she knew she would end up storking this baby. She had hoped that when she finally saw it, looking up at her so helplessly, she might change her mind. But who was she kidding? With neither the skill nor the desire to be a mother at this point in her life, storking had always been her best option. She realizes she's lingered longer than is wise. There's an upstairs light on now, so she forces herself to look away from the sleeping newborn and leaves. With the burden now lifted from her, she has sudden strength. She now has a second chance in life, and this time she'll be smarter. She's sure of it. As she hurries down the street, she thinks how wonderful it is that she can get a second chance. How wonderful it is that she can dismiss her responsibility so easily. 10. Risa. Several streets away from the storked newborn, at the edge of a dense wood, Risa stands at the door of a home. She rings the bell, and a woman answers in her bathrobe. Risa offers the woman a big smile.
Hi, my name is Dee Dee, and I'm collecting clothes and food for our school. We're, like, giving them to the homeless, and it's like this competition. Whoever gets the most wins a trip to Florida or something. So it would be really, really great if you could help out.
The sleepy woman tries to get her brain up to speed with Dee Dee, airhead for the homeless. The woman can't get a word in edgewise because Dee Dee talks way too fast. If Risa had had a piece of chewing gum, she would have popped a bubble somewhere in there to add more authenticity.
Please, please, pretty please. I'm like in second place right now.
The woman at the door sighs, resigned to the fact that Dee Dee isn't going away empty-handed. And sometimes the best way to get rid of girls like this is just to give them something.
I'll be right back, the woman says.
3 minutes later, Risa walks away from the house with a bag full of clothes and canned food.
That was amazing, says Connor, who had been watching with Lev from the edge of the woods.
What can I say? I'm an artist, she says. It's like playing the piano. You just have to know which keys to strike in people.
Connor smiles.
You're right. This is way better than stealing.
Actually, says Lev, scamming is stealing.
Risa feels a bit prickly and uncomfortable at the thought, but tries not to show it.
Maybe so, says Connor, but it's stealing with style.
The woods have ended at a tract community. Manicured lawns have turned yellow along with the leaves. Autumn has truly taken hold. The homes here are almost identical, but not quite. Full of people almost identical, but not quite. It's a world Risa knows about only through magazines and TV. To her, suburbia is a magical kingdom. Perhaps that's why Risa was the one who had the nerve to approach the house and pretend to be Dee Dee. The neighborhood drew her like the smell of fresh bread baking in the industrial ovens of Ohio State Home 23. Back in the woods, where they can't be seen from anyone's window, they check their goodie bag, as if it's full of Halloween candy. There's a pair of pants and a blue button-down shirt that fits Connor. There's a jacket that fits Lev. There are no clothes for Risa, but that's okay. She can play Dee Dee again at a different house. I still don't know how changing our clothes is going to make a difference, Connor asks.
Don't you ever watch TV? Says Risa. On the cop shows, they always describe what perps were last wearing when they put out an APB.
We're not perps, says Connor. We're AWOLs.
We're felons, says Lev. Because what you're doing, I mean what we're doing, is a federal crime.
What, stealing clothes? Asks Connor.
No, stealing ourselves. Once the unwind orders were signed, we all became government property. Kicking AWOL makes us federal criminals.
It doesn't sit well with Risa, or for that matter with Connor, but they both shake it off. This excursion into a populated area is dangerous, but necessary. Perhaps, as the morning goes on, they can find a library where they can download maps and find themselves a wilderness large enough to get lost in for good. There are rumors of hidden communities of AWOL unwinds. Maybe they can find one. As they move cautiously through the neighborhood, a woman approaches them. Just a girl, really, maybe 19 or 20. She walks fast, but she's walking funny, like she's got some injury or is recovering from one. Risa's certain she's going to see them and recognize them, but the girl passes without even making eye contact and hurries around a corner. 11. Connor. Exposed. Vulnerable. Connor wishes they could have stayed in the woods, but there are only so many acorns and berries he can eat. They'll find food in town. Food and information.
This is the best time not to be noticed, Connor tells the others. Everyone's in a hurry in the morning, late to work or whatever.
Connor finds a newspaper in the bushes, misthrown by a delivery boy.
Look at this, says Connor. A newspaper. How retro is that? Does it talk about us? Asks Lev.
He says it like it's a good thing. The three of them scan the front page. The war in Australia, lying politicians. The same old stuff. Connor turns the page clumsily. Its pages are large and awkward. They tear easily and catch the breeze like a kite, making it hard to read. No mention of them on page 2 or page 3.
Maybe it's an old newspaper, suggests Risa.
Connor checks the date on top.
No, it's today's.
He fights against the breeze to turn the page.
Ah, there it is.
The headline reads, Pile Up on Interstate. It's a very small article. A morning car accident, blah, blah, blah. Traffic snarled for hours, blah, blah, blah. The article mentions the dead bus driver, the fact that the road was closed for 3 hours, but nothing about them. Connor reads the last line of the article aloud. It is believed that police activity in the area may have distracted drivers, leading to the accident. They're all dumbfounded. For Connor, there's a sense of relief. A sense of having gotten away with something huge.
That can't be right, says Lev. I was kidnapped, or at least they think I was. That should be in the news. Lev's right, says Risa. They always have incidents with unwinds in the news. If we're not in there, there's a reason.
Connor can't believe these two are looking this gift horse in the mouth. He speaks slowly, as if to idiots. No news report means no pictures. And that means people won't recognize us. I don't see why that's a problem. Risa folds her arms.
Why are there no pictures?
I don't know. Maybe the police are keeping it quiet because they don't want people to know they screwed up.
Risa shakes her head. It doesn't feel right.
Who cares how it feels?
Keep your voice down,
Risa says in an angry whisper. Connor fights to keep his temper under control. He doesn't say anything for fear he's going to start yelling again and draw attention to them. He can see Risa puzzling over the situation and Lev looking back and forth between the two of them.
Risa's not stupid, thinks Connor.
She's going to figure out that this is a good thing and that she's worrying for nothing. But instead, Risa says,
If we're never in the news, then who's going to know if we live or die? See, if it's all over the news that they're tracking us, then when they find us, they have to take us down with tranquilizer bullets and take us to be harvested, right?
Connor has no idea why she's stating the obvious. So, what's your point?
What if they don't want to take us to be unwound? What if they want us dead?
Connor opens his mouth to tell her how stupid that is, but stops himself, because it's not stupid at all.
Lev, says Risa, your family's pretty rich, right?
Lev shrugs modestly.
I guess. What if they paid off the police to get you back by killing the kidnappers, and to do it quietly so no one ever knew it happened?
Connor looks to Lev, hoping the kid will laugh at the very suggestion, telling them that his parents would never, ever do such a terrible thing. Lev, however, is curiously silent about it as he considers the possibility. And at that moment, two things happen. A police car turns onto the street, and somewhere very close by, a baby begins to cry.
Run!
This is the first thought in Connor's mind, his first instinct. But Risa grabs his arm tightly the moment she sees the police car, and it makes him hesitate. Connor knows hesitation can mean the difference between life and death in dire situations, but not today. Today it gives him enough time to do something Connor rarely does in an emergency. He goes beyond his first thought and processes his second thought.
Running will attract attention.
He forces his feet to stay in one place and takes a quick moment to assess their surroundings. Cars are starting in driveways as people head off to work. Somewhere a baby is crying. High school-aged kids are gathered on a corner across the street, talking, pushing each other, laughing. As he looks to Risa, he can tell they're both of one mind, even before she says,
Bus stop.
The patrol car rolls leisurely down the street. Leisurely, that is, to someone who has nothing to hide. But to Connor, its slow pace is menacing. There's no way of telling if these officers are looking for them, or just on a routine patrol. Again, he fights down the urge to run. He and Risa turn their backs to the police car, ready to stride off inconspicuously toward the bus stop. But Lev is not with the program. He faces the wrong way, staring straight at the approaching cop car.
What are you, nuts?
Connor grabs his shoulder and forces him around.
Just do what we do, and act natural.
A school bus approaches from the other direction. The kids at the corner begin gathering their things. Now, at last, there's permission to run without looking out of place. Connor begins it, taking a few strides ahead of Risa and Lev, then turns back, calling with a calculated whine,
Come on, you guys! We're gonna miss the bus again!
The cop car is right beside them now. Connor keeps his back to it and doesn't turn to see if the officers inside are watching them. If they are, hopefully they'll just hear the conversation and assume this is a normal morning mayhem, and not think twice. Lev's version of acting natural is walking with wide eyes and arms stiff by his side like he's crossing a minefield. So much for being inconspicuous.
Do you have to walk so slow?
Connor yells.
If I get another tardy, I'll get detention.
The squad car rolls past them. Up ahead, the bus nears the stop. Connor, Risa, and Lev hurry across the street toward it, all part of the charade, just in case the cops are watching them through their rear-view mirror. Of course, thinks Connor, it could backfire on them. and the cops could cite them for jaywalking.
"Are we really going to get on the bus?"
asks Lev.
"Of course not," says Risa.
Now Connor dares to glance at the cop car. Its blinker is on. It's going to turn the corner, and once it does, they'll be safe. But then the school bus stops and turns on its blinking red lights as it opens its door. And anyone who's ever ridden a school bus knows that when those red lights start blinking, all traffic around them must stop and wait until the bus moves on. The cop car comes to a halt a dozen yards short of the corner, waiting until the bus is finished loading. That means that the cop car will still be sitting right there when the bus pulls away.
"We're screwed," Connor says. "Now we have to get on the bus."
It's as they reach the sidewalk that a sound which has been too faint and too low priority to care about suddenly snares Connor's attention. The crying baby. At the house in front of them, there's a bundle on the porch. The bundle is moving. Connor instantly knows what this is. He's seen it before. He's seen a storked baby twice on his own doorstep. Even though it's not the same baby, he stops in his tracks as if it is.
"Come on, Billy, you'll miss the bus."
"Huh?" It's Risa. She and Lev are a few yards ahead of him. She speaks to Connor through gritted teeth.
"Come on, Billy. Don't be an idiot."
Kids have already started piling onto the bus. The police car sits motionless behind the blinking red lights. Connor tries to make himself move, but can't. It's because of the baby. Because of the way it wails.
"This is not the same baby," Connor tells himself. "Don't be stupid. Not now." "Connor," whispers Risa. "What's wrong with you?"
Then the door of the house opens. There's a fat little kid at the door, 6, maybe 7. He stares down at the baby.
"Aw, no way."
Then he turns and calls back into the house.
"Mom, we've been storked again."
Most people have two emergency modes, fight and flight. But Connor always knew he had three, fight, flight, and screw up royally. It was a dangerous mental short circuit. The same short circuit that made him race back toward armed juvie cops to rescue Lev instead of just saving himself. He could feel it kicking in again right now. He could feel his brain starting to fry.
"We've been storked again,"
the fat kid had said. Why did he have to say again? Connor might have been all right if he hadn't said again.
"Don't do it," Connor tells himself. "This is not the same baby."
But to some deep, unreasoning part of his brain, they're all the same baby. Going against all sense of self-preservation, Connor bolts straight for the porch. He approaches the door so quickly, the kid looks up at him with terrified eyes and backs into his mother, an equally plump woman who has just arrived at the door. Her face wears an unwelcoming scowl. She stares at Connor, then spares a quick glance down at the crying baby, but she makes no move toward it.
"Who are you?"
she demands. The little boy now hides behind her like a cub behind a mother grizzly.
"Did you put this here? Answer me!"
The baby continues to cry.
No, I... "Don't lie to me!"
He doesn't know what he hoped to accomplish coming here. This is none of his business, not his problem. But now he's made it his problem. And behind him, the bus is still loading kids. The police car is still there, waiting. Connor could have very well just ended his life by coming to this house. Then there's a voice behind him.
"He didn't put it there. I did."
Connor turns to see Risa. Her face is stony. She won't even look at Connor. She just glares at the woman, whose beady eyes shift from Connor to Risa.
"You got caught in the act, little dearie,"
she says. The words "little dearie" come out like a curse.
"The law might let you stork, but only if you don't get caught. So take your baby and go before I call those cops over."
Connor tries desperately to unfry his brain.
But...
"Just shut up," says Risa, her voice full of venom and accusation. This makes the woman at the door smile, but it's not a pleasant thing.
Daddy here ruined it for you, didn't he? He came back instead of just running away.
The woman spares a quick, dismissive look at Connor.
First rule of motherhood, dearie. Men are screw-ups. Learn it now and you'll be a whole lot happier.
Between them, the baby still cries. It's like a game of steal the bacon, where no one wants to take the bacon. Finally, Risa bends down and lifts the baby from the welcome mat, holding it close to her. It still cries, but much more softly now.
"Now get out of here," says the fat woman, "or you'll be talking to those cops."
Connor turns to see the cop car partially blocked by the school bus. Lev stands halfway in and halfway out of the bus, keeping the door from closing. A look of utter desperation on his face. The irritated bus driver peers out at him.
"Come on, I don't have all day."
Connor and Risa turn away from the woman at the door and hurry for the bus.
"Risa, I don't," she snaps. "I don't want to hear it."
Connor feels as broken as he did the moment he found out his parents had signed the order to unwind him. Back then, however, he had anger to help dilute the fear and the shock. But there's no anger in him now, except for anger at himself. He feels helpless, hopeless. All of his self-confidence has imploded like a dying star. Three fugitives running from the law, and now, thanks to his short-circuit stupidity, they are three fugitives with a baby. 12. Risa. She can't even begin to guess what possessed Connor. Now Risa realizes he doesn't just make bad decisions, he makes dangerous ones. The school bus only has a few kids on it as they step on, and the driver angrily closes the door behind them, making no comment about the baby. Perhaps because it's not the only baby on the bus. Risa pushes past Lev and leads the three of them to the back. They pass another girl with her own little bundle of joy, which couldn't be any older than 6 months. The young mother curiously eyes them, and Risa tries not to make eye contact. After they're sitting in the back, a few rows away from the nearest riders, Lev looks at Risa, almost afraid to ask the obvious question. Finally, he says,
"Why do we have a baby?"
"Ask him," says Risa. Stone-faced, Connor looks out the window. They're looking for two boys and a girl. Having a baby will throw them off.
"Great," snaps Risa. "Maybe we should all pick up a baby along the way."
Connor goes visibly red. He turns toward her and holds out his hands. "I'll hold it," he says, but Risa keeps it away from him.
"You'll make it cry."
Risa is no stranger to babies. At the state home, she occasionally got to work with the infants. This one probably would have ended up at a state home, too. She could tell that the woman at the door had no intention of keeping it. She looks at Connor. Still red, he intentionally avoids her gaze. The reason Connor gave was a lie. Something else drove him to run to that porch. But whatever the real reason was, Connor's keeping it to himself. The bus comes to a jarring halt and more kids get on. The girl at the front of the bus, the one with the baby, makes her way to the back and sits right in front of Risa, turning around and looking at her over the seat back.
"Hi, you must be new. I'm Alexis, and this is Chase."
Her baby looks at Risa curiously and drools over the seat back. Alexis picks up the baby's limp hand and makes it wave like she might wave the hand of a toy doll.
"Say hello, Chase."
Alexis seems even younger than Risa. Alexis peers around to get a look at the sleeping baby's face.
"A newborn? Oh, wow! That's so brave of you, coming back to school so soon."
She turns to Connor.
"Are you the father?"
"Me?" Connor looks flustered and cornered for a moment before he comes to his senses and says, Yeah, I am."
"That's so great that you're still seeing each other. Chaz, that's Chase's father, doesn't even go to our school anymore. He got sent to military school. His parents were so mad when they found out that I was, you know, uploaded. He was afraid they might actually have him unwound. Can you believe it?"
Risa could strangle this girl if it weren't for the fact that it would leave drooling Chase motherless.
So yours is a boy or a girl?
The pause before answering is awkward and uncomfortable. Risa wonders whether or not there's a discreet way to check without Alexis seeing, but realizes there isn't.
Girl,
Risa says. At least there's a 50% chance she's right.
What's her name?
This time, Connor pipes up. Dee Dee, he says. Her name's Dee Dee. This brings forth a little grin from Risa, in spite of how angry she is at him.
Yeah,
says Risa.
Same as me. Family tradition.
Clearly, Connor has recovered at least a portion of his senses. He seems a bit more relaxed and natural, playing the role as best he can. The redness in his face has receded until it's only his ears that are red.
Well, you're going to love Center North High, Alexis says. They've got a great daycare center and really take care of student mothers. Some teachers even let us nurse in class.
Connor puts his hand over Risa's shoulder.
Do fathers get to watch?
Risa shrugs off his arm and quietly stomps on his foot. He winces, but says nothing. If he thought he was out of the doghouse, he's dead wrong. As far as she's concerned, his name is Fido.
Looks like your brother is making friends, says Alexis.
She looks to where Lev was sitting, but he's moved a seat ahead and is talking to a boy sitting next to him. She tries to hear what they're talking about, but can't hear anything beyond Alexis's blathering.
Or is he your brother? Alexis says to Connor. No, he's mine, says Risa.
Alexis grins and rolls her shoulders a bit.
He's kind of cute.
Risa didn't think it was possible to like Alexis any less than she already did. Apparently she was wrong. Alexis must see the look in Risa's eyes because she says,
well, I mean cute for a freshman.
He's 13. He skipped a grade, Risa says, burning Alexis an even meaner warning gaze that says, keep your claws away from my little brother. She has to remind herself that Lev really isn't her little brother. Now it's Connor's turn to stomp on her foot, and he's right to do it. Too much information. Lev's real age was more than Alexis needed to know, and besides, making an enemy is not in their best interests.
Sorry, says Risa, softening her gaze. Long night with the baby. It's made me cranky.
Oh, believe me, I've totally been there. It looks as if the Alexis Inquisition might continue until they reach the school, but the bus comes to another sudden stop, making little Chase bump his chin on the seat back, and he begins to cry. Suddenly, Alexis goes into mother mode, and the conversation ends. Risa heaves a deep sigh, and Connor says,
I really am sorry about this.
Although he sounds sincere, she's not accepting any apologies. 13. Lev. This day has not gone according to plan. The plan was to get away as soon as they reached civilization. Lev could have run the moment they broke out of the woods. He could have, but he didn't.
There'll be a better time, he had thought.
A perfect time would present itself if he had patience and kept watchful. Pretending to be one of them, pretending to be like them, had taken every ounce of Lev's will. The only thing that kept him going was the knowledge that very soon everything would be as it should be. When the police car had turned onto the street, Lev was fully prepared to throw himself at the car and turn himself in. He would have done it if it weren't for one thing. Their pictures weren't in the paper. That bothered Lev even more than the others. His family was influential. They were not to be trifled with. He felt certain that his face would be the biggest thing on the front page. When it wasn't, he didn't know what to think. Even Reese's theory that his parents wanted her and Connor killed seemed a possibility. If he gave himself up to the police, what if they turned and fired real bullets at Risa and Connor? Would the police do that? He wanted them brought to justice, but he couldn't bear the thought of their deaths on his head, so he had let the squad car go past. And now things are worse. Now there's this baby. Stealing a storked baby? These two unwinds are out of control. He no longer fears that they'll kill him. But that doesn't make them any less dangerous. They need to be protected from themselves. They need to be unwound. Yes, that's the best solution for these two. They're of no use to anyone in their current state, least of all themselves. It would probably be a relief for them, for now they're all broken up on the inside. Better to be broken up on the outside instead. That way their divided spirits could rest, knowing that their living flesh was spread around the world, saving lives, making other people whole, just as his own spirit would soon rest. He ponders this as he sits on the bus, trying to deny how mixed his feelings about it are. While Risa and Connor talk to a painfully perky girl and her baby, Lev moves one seat forward in the bus, putting more distance between them. A boy gets on the bus and sits down next to him, wearing headphones and singing to music that Lev can't hear. The kid slips his backpack in between them on the seat, practically wedging Lev in, and returns his full attention to his tunes. That's when Lev gets an idea. He looks behind him to see Connor and Risa still involved with the other girl and her baby. Carefully, Lev reaches into the kid's backpack and pulls out a dog-eared notebook. Written on it in big black letters is "Death by Algebra," with little skulls and crossbones. Inside are messy math equations and homework graded down for sloppiness. Lev quietly turns to a blank page. Then he reaches into the kid's pack again, pulling out a pen. All the while, the kid is so absorbed in his music, he doesn't notice. Lev begins to write. "Help. I'm being held hostage by two AWOL unwinds. Nod if you understand." When he's done, he tugs the boy's shoulder. It takes two tugs to get his attention. "Yeah?" Lev holds out the notebook, making sure he does it in such a way that it's not too obvious. The boy looks at him and says, "Hey, that's my notebook." Lev takes a deep breath. Connor's looking at him now. He's got to be careful. "I know it's your notebook," Lev says, trying to say as much as he can with his eyes. "I just needed one page." He holds the notebook a little higher for the kid to read, but the kid's not even looking at it. "No, you should have asked first." Then he rips out the page without even looking at it, crumples the paper, and to Lev's horror, hurls it toward the front of the bus. The paper wad bounces off the head of another kid, who ignores it, and it falls to the floor. The bus comes to a stop, and Lev feels his hope trampled beneath 30 pairs of scuffed shoes. 14. Connor. Dozens of buses pull up to the school. Kids mob every doorway. As Connor gets off the bus with Risa and Lev, he scans for a way to escape, but there is none. There are campus security guards and teachers on patrol. Anyone seen walking away from school would draw the attention of everyone watching.
"We can't actually go in," says Risa.
"I say we do," says Lev, acting more squirrely than usual.
A teacher has already taken notice of them. Even though the school has a daycare center for student mothers, the baby is very conspicuous.
"We'll go in," says Connor. "We'll hide in a place where there aren't any security cameras, the boys' bathroom."
"Girls," says Risa, "it'll be cleaner, and there'll be more stalls to hide in."
Connor considers it and figures she's probably right on both counts. "Fine. We'll hide until lunch, then slip out with the rest of the kids going off campus."
"You're assuming this baby wants to cooperate," says Risa. "Eventually, it's going to want to be fed, and I don't exactly have the materials, if you know what I mean. If it starts crying in the bathroom, it'll probably echo throughout the whole school."
It's another accusation. Connor can hear it in her voice. It says,
"Do you have any idea how much harder you've made things on us?"
"Let's just hope it doesn't cry," says Connor. "And if it does, you can blame me all the way to harvest camp."
Connor is no stranger to hiding in school bathrooms. Of course, before today, the reason was simply to get out of class. Today, however, there's no class where he's expected, And if he's caught, the consequences are a little bit more severe than Saturday school. They slip in after the first period bell rings, and Connor coaches them on the finer points of bathroom stealth. How to tell the difference between kids' footsteps and adults. When to lift your feet up so no one can see you, and when to just announce that the stall is occupied. The latter would work for both Risa and Lev, since his voice is still somewhat high, but Connor doesn't dare pretend to be a girl. They stay together, yet alone, each in their own stall. Mercifully, the bathroom door squeals like a pig whenever it's opened, so they have warning when anyone comes in. There are a few girls at the beginning of first period, but then it quiets down, and they are left with no sound but the echoing drizzle of a leaky flush handle.
"We won't make it here until lunch," Risa announces from the stall to Connor's left, "even if the baby stays asleep."
"You'd be surprised how long you can hide in a bathroom."
"You mean you've done this often?" asks Lev in the stall to his right.
Connor knows this fits right into Lev's image of Connor as a bad seed. Fine, let him think that. He's probably right. The bathroom door squeals. They fall silent. Dull, rapid footsteps. It's a student in sneakers. Lev and Connor raise their feet, and Risa keeps hers down, as they had planned. The baby gurgles, and Risa clears her throat, masking the noise perfectly. The girl is in and out in less than a minute. After the bathroom door squeaks closed, the baby coughs. Connor notices that it's a quick, clean sound. Not sickly at all. Good.
"By the way," says Risa, "it is a girl."
Connor thinks to offer to hold it once more, but figures right now that would be more trouble than it's worth. He doesn't know how to hold a baby to keep it from crying. Connor decides he has to tell them why he went temporarily insane and took the baby. He owes them that much.
"It was because of what that kid said," Connor says gently.
"What?"
"Back at that house, the fat kid at the door, he said they'd been storked again."
"So what?" says Risa. "Lots of people get storked more than once." Then, from his other side, Connor hears,
"That happened to my family. I have two brothers and a sister who were brought by the stork before I was born. It was never a problem."
Connor wonders if Lev actually thinks the stork brought them, or if he's just using it as an expression. He decides he'd rather not know. What a wonderful family. They take in storked babies and send their own flesh and blood to be unwound. Oh, sorry, tithed. Clearly offended, Lev says,